I think this time I'll do a podcast.
Welcome to the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Ben Heisler.
All right, everybody, welcome in. This is episode 3 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. Ben Heisler with you. Glad that you have decided to join us today. This is going to be a fun episode. I'm joined by Joe Lucia and Ken Fang from Awful Announcing coming up in a little bit. We'll give you, one of our listeners, an opportunity to win $50 to Amazon, courtesy of our great friends at Clipit, the presenting sponsor of the Awful Announcing Podcast. So happy to have them on board for this as well. And our feature guest today, someone that I've had the opportunity to work with back before I was doing stuff for Awful Announcing, back before I was in Kansas City, a former colleague of mine over at MLB Network Radio. Now he is the face of Turner Sports when it comes to baseball coverage, and that's Casey Stern. You can catch NLCS coverage with Gary Sheffield, Pedro Martinez, and Jimmy Rollins on their coverage on TBS. So looking forward to having a great conversation with Casey Stern. We'll bring that to you coming up in just a bit. But Joe Lucia and Ken Fanger here for our roundtable. Gentlemen, it is good to have you here. ESPN is going to be back once again leading the discussion, and Barstool Sports has now entered into the mix, and that was not received well by one Sam Ponder. It seems that Barstool, their fearless leader, and Sam have not necessarily gotten along well throughout the beginning. So, Ken, I'll start with you. Were you surprised that the way this was all handled from the very beginning, where you knew that there was a relationship that really wasn't addressed here, and that there was going to be some problem from the very beginning? Why wasn't this addressed in the early process?
You would think that, Ben, and you would think that somehow ESPN would have let their employees know. And I don't know the exact internal process of how that came about, but, you know, it just seems like this was festering. And there was a speculation that maybe, and we thought about this maybe at Awful Announcing internally, that maybe there was a reminder of what somehow a reminder to Sam Ponder yesterday or this week. In regards to what Barstool had said about her in the past, and it just, she just decided to come out and say it on Twitter. And you know, at first she went after the big cat of Barstool Sports, and of course he said, look, I didn't write the things that you said I wrote, and the things that were said on the rundown that aired on Comedy Central. But she came out guns a blazing on this, and you know, of course, their fearless leader David Portnoy didn't like it at all. He came about and he's come out with guns a blazing the day after this. But it's been interesting how this has been handled. I think it took ESPN aback, and it took them totally by surprise, because I know that they're hoping that to start this relationship with Barstool with the new show that's premiering this week. So it's interesting how this all came about, and I have a feeling that we may have to have a meeting of the minds here between ESPN, their employees, and Barstool, just to get at least on the same page, because ESPN doesn't like to see ESPN on ESPN crime. They don't want to see their employees attack new partners and partners who are coming about, especially Barstool, in this type of manner.
Yeah, this is a really not ideal situation right now for ESPN, because they have this show debuting that, I mean, I don't know what they're trying to get out of this. It's going to be a show that it's going to get a lot of negative attention from some people, but that's not really the target audience. These aren't the people that are going to constantly watch the Barstool show and patronize the Barstool website. That's not the audience that ESPN seems to be going for here, but that's kind of the loudest critic right now. So I don't know if they just did not expect that these people would be getting upset about this, or if they thought it was just going to blow over, but it really hasn't right now. And we're in a situation where by the time this podcast will come out, the show will have already debuted and will have already gotten probably the both positive and negative reactions that a lot of people expected. I'm really not sure what anybody involved with this situation really thought was going to happen, aside from what we've seen so far. And I'm really wondering if they're just going to kind of stop promoting it on their social media channels, which they really have done over the last week or so since the official announcement. The Barstool announcement has really been everywhere. And I'm wondering if we're going to see them start to go in another direction after the first episode premieres.
It's just fascinating to me that, you know, something like this is coming. you understand that there's going to be some people already, if you do your homework as ESPN, knowing that Barstool is very hit or miss, that they have a very engaged, a very supportive part of their audience, and they also know that they're going to upset a lot of people too, and you would have just thought that at least in the process of doing their research, that they would have known that there were some things said about ESPN personalities, and ESPN personalities more than ever feel more compelled to stand up for themselves, to fight back, even if it's ESPN on ESPN crime. So the fascinating part about this for me is that it just seems like a complete lack of preparation on ESPN's part for knowing that something like this could happen, and this is happening, now it's unfolding right in front of them.
Sure. And like you said, I mean, this isn't new. This isn't something that just came out and they just discovered these awful, terrible things were said. This is old news. This has been around for a while. I'm not sure why so many people are so shocked and appalled by this. ESPN knew what they were getting into with Barstool. This is what they do. And we can talk about how angry and mean and cruel and everything is, but it's not as if ESPN had no idea what they were signing up for. They knew that this could have happened. This was going to be a side effect. So I'm not really sure why ESPN might be coming off here and looking at this situation as, oh, well, we had absolutely no idea that we were going to get this kind of feedback. Of course you knew this was going to happen. It's Barstool. It's what they do.
Ken, were you surprised that all of this continued to unfold the way they did? And furthermore, with regards to the show and the audience that Barstool and ESPN are trying to collect, there certainly has to be some cross-section there, factoring in the NFL audience, that they're going to want the people that are watching Barstool to come and tune in for their Sunday NFL countdown show. If you're already creating a rift between personalities, because they are falling under the ESPN umbrella for this sense, at some point, how is this fixed?
You know, I don't know how this is going to be fixed. ESPN has done these things, tried to get on the cutting edge. They tried to do it with Rush Limbaugh back in the 1990s. And then they act like they're so shocked that this is what he does. You know, when he made the comments about Donovan McNabb and black quarterbacks, everyone was seen to be so shocked that he was like this. And now the situation comes in here with Barstool Sports some two decades later. And I agree with Joe. They knew what they were getting into. They knew what was coming about on this. So for them to see this whole thing transpire, and we're all watching it in real time, and we're all watching it on social media, it's going to be interesting to see how this is going to happen. I mean, is this going to be addressed on their first show? We're going to find out. And it's going to be very interesting to watch the relationship now, because as we mentioned, ESPN doesn't like to see employees rag on each other, and they don't want to see this internal struggle like they're seeing right now. So how this is going to be resolved is anyone's guess, and it's going to be interesting. We're watching it in real time, and it's going to be very interesting to see how it all transpires.
It's obviously off to a rocky start, but can Barstool work on ESPN? Do you guys think it would have been better off on a different network, like a Viceland, HBO, Comedy Central type of situation? Is ESPN ultimately the right partner for Barstool moving forward?
I know what they're trying to do. They want to try to bring in that like younger, edgier audience. But is it even an hour time slot? I think it's only a half hour time slot, and it's one day a week at 1 a.m. I mean, to quote our boss, is the juice worth the squeeze here? I really don't think it is.
Yeah, I think that it's probably better off to be on a Viceland or perhaps on a Comedy Central, where they actually Barstool had a partnership during Super Bowl week. I think it probably would be worked better there. But I do understand what ESPN is trying to do. They're trying to get a new audience. They're trying to get a younger audience. And they're trying to get kids who are watching at 1 a.m. who will probably be there for them. But it's a strange partnership. ESPN is all about the bottom line. It's all about the brand. It's all about trying to ensure that Disney wants to be the happiest place on earth. ESPN is not necessarily that, but the fact is that Disney tries to be everything for everybody. And I'm not sure that this partnership is going to work down the road. Maybe Barstool will take their show down to another network right now, but I think that it probably would have been better off on a Viceland or a Comedy Central or maybe even another network that gets more of their humor and gets more of their audience.
I said it at the end of the first podcast. I'm going to say it again. That great Mitch Hedberg quote, "You can't please all the people all the time, and it just so happens that those people were at my show." I'm with you, Ken. The idea that ESPN is trying to please everybody, and they're just not going to be able to do it, and ultimately you have to find a way to, A, keep the bottom line, but, B, have a plan moving forward where at least you have everybody, for the most part, on the same page. If you're trying to set a precedent right now that everybody needs to be able to be communicating and being on the same page moving forward, they certainly haven't had any luck with that. And that transitions well into the situation with Jemele Hill, her situation moving forward with Six at 6 p.m. Eastern. The whole thing is just a mess. And I had such high hopes for that show because I really liked both what I saw from Jemele and Michael Smith, and His and Hers was a terrific show with remarkable chemistry. And I like the idea that ESPN was open to a change at SportsCenter, that it wasn't going to be the same type of show that we had seen before, that they were going to have a little bit more fun, that they knew that as far as highlights were concerned, that we were already getting them on our phone and popping up on our computer to begin with. But now that Jemele Hill is working her way back to the Six, it certainly appears that ESPN is in a bit of a situation to try and figure out what they do. If this is their flagship program, how do they make it, like you said, Ken, open and as available to as many consumers as possible? Do you see this relationship, Jemele Hill, ESPN, SportsCenter, whatever, do you see that working out long term with them?
I don't. And I wrote something about that this week. Richard Deitch of Sports Illustrated predicted that Hill wouldn't be long for ESPN. And in his podcast with ESPN writer, ESPN book writer, James Andrew Miller, he agreed that the SportsCenter 6 is SE6 is probably not long either. And I happen to agree with that. I think it's a great experiment, and I thought it was a great idea to do some personality-driven SportsCenters. But now that you have Jemele Hill, who is polarizing, at least to one side of the political landscape, I think ESPN is going to have to do something, cut bait with her, maybe the show, and eventually – probably contract-wise as well. It's just at a point where she's just almost at a point where it's similar to where Bill Simmons and Curt Schilling were, that they just had no choice but to cut bait with them, and they may have to do the same with Jemele Hill down the road.
What do you think, Joe?
Yeah, I completely agree with Ken. I think what ESPN kind of overlooked here was, even though that so many people don't consume SportsCenter the way they used to, the SportsCenter brand is still quite strong, and I think a lot of people kind of saw Jemele Hill, Michael Smith going on to the 6 p.m. SportsCenter and kind of rechristening it the 6 and changing up the format. I think a lot of people kind of took that and really ran with it the wrong way, even though they might not have watched the show nearly as much as they have. The SportsCenter brand is still so strong, and they saw what they felt was an affront to the brand of how it was being changed and turned into something different and unrecognizable, and they did not like that. And I think that's something that ESPN really kind of has to think about in the future when going to these branded sports centers. Because the Scott Van Pelt one, it retains a lot of the same things as the standard sports center that we've come to grow and love over the years. Whereas this SC6, I mean, it is not for everyone. It is a much different show than I think a lot of us really expected. It's a lot different. And I think it was too drastic of a change for a lot of people. And I think they're going to have to do something else with it. I don't think they can walk Smith and Hill back to His and Hers time slot in the middle of the afternoon. So they're really in a difficult situation here.
I'm glad you brought up the Scott Van Pelt Sports Center, because I think you're spot on in your analysis that it still has a lot of the same, you know, it's like coming back for a home-cooked meal, that it may not necessarily taste the same each and every time, but there's something that's very relatable about it. There's something that you understand. And I also think, for the fact that it's at night, and late at night, and you can still incorporate some highlights into it, because in the daytime, it's been more focused towards stories and narratives and interviews, and the Six is also a lot of preview and setup and point counterpoint stuff. Like, is that just what was time slot a primary reason for Van Pelt's success? Was it just the fact that he was a household name for SportsCenter? What do you think sort of stood apart from his version of SportsCenter and his presentation of SportsCenter versus some of the others?
I think it was kind of not only just similar to his radio show, but also a mixture of that and a traditional SportsCenter, Ben. I think that's reason why it's worked so well, because we're seeing the traditional interviews that Scott has done so well doing, and also, you know, highlights, some highlights there, and also a lot of his personality, his one big thing that he's seen. So I think that those elements have worked, and especially being late at night, coming off a live event, whether it's Sunday Night Football or Monday Night Football or a college basketball game, those are his strengths. And I think with the six, I think that you're trying to go into live sports and you're trying to do elements that not necessarily will work on a sports center, but would work on a his and hers. And I think that's where fans who are so used to watching the 6 o'clock sports center and with the previews of the night's action and interviews, I think that's where they got a personal front, because they weren't used to seeing those elements that worked well on his and hers, but wouldn't necessarily work on a sports center.
Yeah, I completely agree with Ken there. It's the 6 p.m. sports center was always, it was always a tough nut to crack, just based on when it was airing in the day. There weren't a lot of highlights to air at 6 p.m. If you looked at it as just a preview show, it kind of fell flat, kind of like FS1 tried and failed to do with America's Pregame. So you have this show that really doesn't know what it is or what it will be, and it just wasn't much of anything, and it was always tough to kind of get a lock on it. And then you completely upend it with bringing in Jamel Hill, Michael Scott, or Michael Smith, excuse me, and something completely.
You know what, that would have been a great show. I mean, I had no disrespect to Michael Smith, but if you had Jamel Hill and Michael Scott, that is a show that I would watch.
Man, yeah, I don't think Steve Carell's going back to TV anytime soon, so good luck with that.
Good stuff, as we're talking with Joe Lucia and Ken Fang here of Awful Announcing on the Awful Announcing podcast, discussing sort of the future of SportsCenter and ESPN and the situation with regards to Barstool and Sam Ponder and what's happening here. I want to do one final question on ESPN before we move on to some of the other major topics in sports media this week. I think it was either last podcast, maybe, which was a couple weeks ago, when Katie Nolan was announced that she would be joining ESPN. It might have been the first one. I don't remember. Time seems to sort of get lost inside my brain. But now that she is there, and now that ESPN, and there is a network that says, we want Katie Nolan, we want to make sure that Katie Nolan does something interesting and unique for our channel, which was different to where she was before, where they couldn't really figure out a place for her. Do you guys have any sort of predictions as to what you might see from her? I think one of the predictions, and Ken, it might have been yours, so I don't want to steal it, was maybe she ends up taking over for Michelle Beadle, the Beatles joining Mike Greenberg, and she heads out to L.A., or maybe she does it from New York. I don't know, but I'm curious to get your guys' thoughts on sort of what role she'll take on at ESPN.
It's really strange, because I never thought of her as a really good fit at ESPN, because the things they do really well and specialize in, it's not what she does. I mean, she's not much of like a reporter or an interviewer. She's, I don't want to call her a comedy act, but she's more loose with what she does. And I honestly think they'll kind of debut her as, I don't want to, this sounds like a really bad comparison. I almost think like they'll kind of debut her in something like a Frank Caliendo role, where it's just kind of popping in on an established show for like a little 5-minute segment, doing something kind of funny, kind of not that serious or too deep, just kind of get her feet wet and get everyone used to her. And as from there, I almost think I could see her getting some kind of late night slot like that, like the Barstool show, like the Scott Van Pelt Sports Center. I really don't know how it would work out, but I think that is what I could end up seeing in her future there once things start to settle a little bit.
It's going to be interesting to see where ESPN slots are. I mean, I think they wanted to make the move to get her away from FS1 just to say, hey, we got another one of their personalities away. They've already taken people like Julie Stewart Banks and also Molly McGrath. So here's another one that, you know, a former FS1 personality that comes over to ESPN. But unlike those other two who are established in what they do, you know, where is, I agree with Joe, where do you put her? I mean, Sports Nation may be a possibility, but she's not really a moderator or a host. She's more established as herself, more on social media and also on Garbage Time. So does ESPN try to do a Garbage Time, or do they try to take NFL Films Presents, which currently she's continuing to be on FS1, even though she's not on have a show there. So what do they exactly do? It's going to be interesting to see how they slot her in, because she doesn't really fit a traditional role as on ESPN, as Joe said.
I hate to say where she's best likely to fit, because I think her versatility allows her to do a lot of things. I think you make a really good point, Joe, in the sense that they might try and say, okay, let's sort of get a general sense and use your strengths to our advantage. I think a lot of those sort of smaller segments that she could incorporate into Sunday NFL Countdown, I think, would work really well. And I also wonder if she's going to keep the late night format. It was sort of like what Olbermann had back before they moved him to the middle of the afternoon. You sort of had this ESPN2 alternative to SportsCenter, where you had more of a type of commentary with Olbermann. I wonder whether or not maybe like an 11 o'clock show on the Deuce could possibly work for Katie Nolan as well.
Man, now that you brought up that Olbermann show, I think that could be a good comparison, you know, kind of studio away from everyone else. You have a couple of segments that are just kind of off the cuff, an opening monologue, an interview or two. Something like that, I think, would end up working really well for her.
Yeah, and I think it's part of her strength. Certainly on the commentary side, we know she's terrific. I think they're looking for a little bit of creativity on the other side. The question is whether or not they're comfortable with trying to take people away from the growing audience that they have from SportsCenter with Scott Van Pelt. If they feel like they want to issue out an alternative, I think that could work really well for her. Hopefully we'll start to see her more and more on ESPN. All right, so I want to actually move over to the Fox side, because about a week or so ago, we saw a tremendous upset in the world of soccer. And that is the U.S., which Fox has spent a boatload of money on as far as World Cup coverage. They're not going to have arguably their best moneymaker in the U.S. playing in the World Cup. Fox has spent a lot of money here, guys. Is there any way for them to be able to salvage this, knowing that the U.S. men's national team is not going to be a part of their coverage?
Good question. I know that they kind of had a contingency plan in place by saying that Mexico would be their second home team. But to be honest with you, Telemundo is going to be the one that where the Hispanic audience is going to be watching. So whether Fox can latch on and get an English speaking audience to be interested in Mexico, that's going to be interesting to see. But to have the United States be eliminated as they were last week in shocking fashion, or maybe not so shocking fashion, as Taylor Twellman has been kind of warning us in the past. How Fox is going to handle this is going to be quite interesting. Maybe they can go for nice little stories like Iceland, which is qualified for the World Cup, or do more stories about Russia as the host nation for the World Cup. But as far as being able to at least depend on three United States games, unfortunately, they're going to have to wait until 2022, at least for that.
In a word, no. There's no way to replace the U.S. men's national team in this World Cup. They're the ones who got all the huge viewership numbers on ABC and ESPN 4 years ago, and Fox is not going to have that this year. It's simply a basic fact. They're not going to have those huge viewership numbers for those games. And the awful times of these games airing from Russia aren't going to help them with the...
No, not at all.
Either. So I think they're just kind of going to try to write this one off, say, well, we didn't get this, we didn't get the U.S., we didn't get the great times, but you know what? It's okay. We still have the rights in another 4 years and 8 years also down the road. I think they're just kind of going to use this World Cup as almost like, I don't want to call it a dry run because it's such a huge event and there's still going to be so much going on. But I think they're going to kind of look at it and say, okay, a lot did not go right for us. We will hopefully get a better draw in 2022 and can learn from some of our lessons next time around.
And so while Fox might be screwed with their soccer coverage, at least they might have a compelling World Series this year. You got some major markets still left. At least we're recording this podcast on a Tuesday, so currently still Houston, New York, Chicago, and the Dodgers are still involved, so maybe they'll still get a decent number for the World Series. But as far as baseball is concerned, you had at the start of the playoffs baseball coverage on four different networks. You had it on MLB Network, you had it on TBS, a couple games on ESPN, and then again with Fox Sports 1. So it's crazy to think that it's coming in from all these different places. There's different extension talks for the different markets that could begin in 2019. There's also talks that ESPN, who has been a very good friend to Major League Baseball, might start to reduce some of their coverage. And the fact that even though you need game rights, baseball has a problem in the fact of it's such a local phased and a local based sport. Do you see any way for these markets to continue to remain strong and these television stations to say, you know what, we need to continue to invest in baseball? Because from a local market, the TV revenue is going up. From a national perspective, it is very tough to sell baseball right now.
Since I'm a huge baseball guy, I'll go first on this one. ESPN actually had a pretty good year with Sunday Night Baseball. I think the ratings were up something like 12 to 15% for the season, which for them is good. But you have to look at it this way. They have this Sunday night plan. They have the Monday night games. They have the Wednesday night games. That's a lot of real estate, and that's a lot to invest in a sport that, I mean, let's be honest here. The audience is skewing older. It's not a game that's going to attract a lot of the younger viewers that networks are constantly trying to grapple for. And then you have that Turner package, which is really just bizarre because they have Sunday afternoon games – for the second half of the season, and nobody really watches those games. They're not exclusive broadcasts like the ESPN Sunday night games. They're just kind of there. They're not a huge draw. They don't have like that, you know, like that Dan Shulman, Joe Buck kind of broadcaster that kind of anchors that coverage. It seemingly rotates every week as to who's in the booth. And even in these playoffs, I mean, Ernie Johnson's been the guy for years. He's not doing the coverage this year because of the NBA season starting earlier. They really don't have that established long-time baseball exclusive voice. I really think...
Joe Simpson, Joe. They have Joe Simpson. Let's not forget about that.
Started on Joe Simpson, my favorite announcer in the world. But I think when these rights come up, I think it's in 3 or 4 years, everything expires. Yeah. I think you're going to kind of see ESPN kind of... ESPN is going to stay in the game, but I think they're going to consolidate their package a little bit. I think they're going to end up keeping something like Sunday nights and maybe like a Monday night game and kind of free up the rest of the week. I think Turner's going to get out of the game. I think Fox is still going to stay with them, stay strong, because Fox and MLB have been together for something like 20 years now. They have this, they have a pretty lengthy relationship. And as for another package, I mean, I really can't see any of these other broadcasters kind of getting in the game, like NBC and CBS. I can't even consider either of them making a big step. I think you could see an online outlet like an Amazon or a Facebook or a Twitter end up taking a Monday night or a Wednesday night package, just because they've been kind of dipping their toe in the water a little bit this season with some of those games. I think they could expand upon that a little bit next year as well.
I agree, Joe, and I think Turner has been, you know, ever since they came into the postseason game, and basically their contract has been so postseason loaded, especially when they began in 2007, and their coverage has been so polarizing, starting with Chip Carey and going all the way down to Ernie Johnson down the line, as you mentioned, not a real a guy who has that gravitas as Dan Shulman or Joe Buck on baseball, but I agree with you. I can see Turner getting out. I don't see CBS and NBC getting into it. I can see MLB Network maybe taking a Wednesday night package because they want to expand their basically they can pick up any game, but I can see them doing an exclusive package for Wednesday night baseball and improving on that, what they have currently, and maybe even expanding their postseason portfolio by taking one or two division series, the entire division series, instead of two division series games and taking them from FS1, which they currently do. So as far as online is concerned, I could also see a Facebook expand their portfolio also. But as far as getting to the postseason, I don't see that happening. I still see Major League Baseball still wanting to reach the masses with television and network television, at least with Fox. So where they go is going to be quite interesting. Maybe they can do something also with the NBA and the NHL do, and allowing some local broadcasts and at least getting some local rights for their first round for the League Division Series. So I'd like to see that happen. That probably won't happen, but that's just my wish. But Major League Baseball is in a very interesting spot, as they see, like, local attendance is okay. Local ratings are going up, but as far as national ratings are concerned, Fox, especially on their afternoon games, are just absolutely horrible. So where they go from as a national standpoint is going to be quite interesting when the rights come up in early next decade.
That's the fascinating part to me, is that baseball has been by no means in a rough situation, because they know that the money is there. They know that the local rights, that there's still plenty of markets that are paying absurd amount of money to have those local rights for the game, because it's just such a localized sport. I think once baseball starts to figure out how to properly market on a national level, and it's going to take them a long time. This isn't going to happen overnight for them. But I think one way to possibly do that is the idea that Joe had. Use more social media outlets. Use Amazon. Use Facebook. Use Twitter. Use what a younger audience is using, besides that typical mid-40s to 50s male that's watching the game on his local television station. You know, if you're able to expand out and at least think outside the box, I think that's another positive step for baseball. All right, final one for you guys. We are taping this podcast on the season premiere of the NBA, and I saw a story that I think 21 different ESPN analysts and writers all gave their predictions for the upcoming NBA season, and in a move that was shocking to nobody, all 21 ESPN analysts and writers picked the Golden State Warriors to win the championship. So no real surprise there, but I will leave this question with you guys as we wrap up the roundtable portion of the podcast. If not the Warriors, then who? Ken, I'll start with you.
Some team in China? I have no idea. No, seriously, I'd like to see maybe Cleveland actually try to do, or maybe the Celtics, my hometown team. But to be honest with you, you know, I really don't see who would defeat the Warriors at this point, unless all five of their starters go down in one heap in one game. So unless we see something really, really strange this season, and as Charles Barkley said in the TNT conference call this week previewing the season, he'd hate to just go in a charade of pretending for 7 months someone other than the Cavs and the Warriors will meet in the finals this season. So, you know, I just don't see anybody, unless something really, really crazy happens this season, of we're going to see a trilogy of the Cavs and Warriors again in the finals, with the Warriors probably winning.
You got a crazy prediction for me, Joe?
Well, I can say that the Celtics probably will not do a whole lot in terms of the championship, because it looks like Gordon Hayward just broke his ankle in graphic fashion tonight. So that is not a good sign for Boston. It's so easy to just say that the Warriors are going to win the title, and I think they're going to, because they're clearly head and shoulders the best team in the league. I want to say we'll see what happens, but I mean, let's be honest here. It's, unless something really devastating happens, I don't see them getting knocked off.
Yeah, I don't either. I think if you're going to go ahead and look at it from a gambling perspective, which is always fun for me, Houston, San Antonio, and the Oklahoma City Thunder are all 16-1, I believe, last time I checked. So if Ken were to be right, that if all five Golden State starters were consequently hit by a bus, then I would like those odds for those three teams. If not, I think it's right now it's -240. So you'd have to bet $240 for Golden State just to make $100 to win a championship, which is just insane odds. So hopefully the NBA season will be compelling, and it should have some drama throughout, and especially if Gordon Hayward went down. As you mentioned, Joe, that should be a little bit ridiculous and insane as well. All right, gentlemen, I appreciate your time. As always, that's Joe Lucia and Ken Fang. You read them over at Alpha Announcing and follow them on Twitter as well. Coming up in just a little bit, we will talk to Casey Stern, my conversation with the TBS baseball studio host, along with the host over at MLB Network Radio on Inside Pitch. But coming up, it's an opportunity for you guys to win $50 to Amazon.com. You just got to play our little game that's courtesy of our friends over at Clip It. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast, presented by Clip It.
You're listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast, presented by Clip It. Download the Clip It app today on iOS and Android.
All right, welcome back. It is the Awful Announcing Podcast. It is presented by our good friends at Clip It. If you got a movie, a TV show, sports event, highlight, whatever you want to send in the form of a clip, Clip It has it, and you can download the app today on iOS or on Android. The perfect way to send whatever you want in the form of a clip to friends and family or whoever else you want to be able to send it to, that is the Clip It app. We have an opportunity for a caller and a listener who got today's guest right, and of course it is Casey Stern of TBS, and Turner and MLB Network Radio is our feature guest today. And Abe in Los Angeles was the guy that got it correct. What's going on, Abe?
Oh, not too much. Everything is cool here. It's interesting. My first time here in L.A. over the past couple of months, the Eastern start times are all messing with me. I'm still at work as most of the games finish up, so that's not cool, but everything's good.
Well, I'm glad you're enjoying some of the games and some of the action. We appreciate you listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast. This is how the game works, Abe, if you haven't had a chance to listen to the previous couple of episodes. We have a couple clips that are courtesy of Clip It. We will play them for you. If you get both of them right by identifying the clip, you'll win $50 to Amazon, thanks to our friends from Clip It. You get one right, you get $25 to Amazon, and if you get both of them wrong, well, at least you played and you had the great experience of a lifetime playing on this podcast. Are you ready to go?
Yeah, let's go.
Okay. The first clip comes to us from this ESPN analyst who was bewildered at what he saw out of the U.S. men's national team. Take a listen.
It's not about tonight. It's not about Jurgen Klinsmann. It's not just about Bruce Arena. As a whole, U.S. soccer is not prepared. They have not done a good enough job of getting this group ready to play. And keep in mind, the last two Olympics, no United States. So a lot of people on social media right now want to say it's Jurgen Klinsmann's fault, it's Bruce Arena's fault, it's Sunil Gulati's fault. By the way, as an ex-player, every single one of those players,
they can take some
nightmares
yep.
for the rest of their lives, because this is an utter embarrassment.
What are we doing? What are we doing? That part was not part of the clip, but Abe in L.A., can you tell us the name of the ESPN analyst that went off on the U.S. men's national team?
You gotta love the emotion and the passion of Taylor Twellman.
Nicely done. Taylor Twellman was the answer, and I think that was part of the mild part of his rant on ESPN, but he's always been outstanding. So nicely done. $25 to Amazon.com is yours. The second clip that we have courtesy of Clip It is a little bit shorter, and it was this Hall of Fame announcer, well, having his Ron Burgundy moment. Take a listen.
On the Visa Halftime Report, Kurt Terry, Howie, Michael, and Tony look on graphic for the final two bullet points.
Abe in L.A., can you tell me which Hall of Famer just had that type of moment where someone might have typed a question into the teleprompter?
Oh, that is the one and only Dick Stockton.
Dick Stockton, indeed, and that was a rough broadcast with Mark Schlereth. Well, Abe, you made that look very easy. $50 to Amazon.com is yours. Thanks so much for playing. Thanks for listening to the podcast, and enjoy your time out in beautiful Los Angeles, man. We'll talk to you again soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me. You're doing a great job, Ben. Always listening. Appreciate it. Happy to spend some money at Amazon.
There you go. That was Abe in L.A. Coming up on the other side, my conversation with Turner Sports and MLB Network Radio's Casey Stern. A fantastic story he opens up with us. More than we have heard from him in the past. Do not go anywhere. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast.
Welcome back to the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Ben Heisler.
Welcome back. It is the Awful Announcing Podcast. It is presented by Clip It. Download the Clip It app today on iOS or Android, and do not miss an opportunity to share your favorite videos with your friends and family the way you want with the Clip It app. I'm really excited to talk to our feature guest today. It was a guy that I was able to call a teammate of mine for 3+ years over at MLB Network Radio on Sirius XM. He's the host of Inside Pitch, which you can listen to from 2 to 6 p.m. Eastern. He's also a studio host for Turner Sports. You can see him hosting TBS's coverage currently of the NLCS with the great Pedro Martinez, Gary Sheffield, Jimmy Rollins. His story is great. He's a great guy. He's kind enough to join us here on the Awful Announcing Podcast. It's Casey Stern. How are you, Case?
What's up, Benny? How we doing, buddy?
Everything is good. It's great to talk to you. I know that you're a very busy man in the midst of several different jobs. And I want to start with your first job that sort of got you into this entire process. If we go back several years and go back to the dream job days, I'm curious how you first heard about it, how you applied, and how that whole process began for you.
Yeah, you know, I went to school for this and at Boston University, and my whole life, my dream was to do this for a living. I
even going back to, geez, when I auditioned for Dream Job, I remember telling them, which was true, you know, they asked, you know, when did you first know you were going to do this? And I remember in, like, first grade, everybody raised their hands when they said, hey, what do you want to be when you grow up? And, you know, an astronaut, and, you know, I want to be a scientist, and I want to save lives. And I was the dope who said I wanted to be Bob Murphy. I mean, and nobody even knew who that was. So, of course, for those who don't now, by the way, still probably listening to our the great longtime late voice of the Mets. Yeah, I always wanted to be a guy who can be involved in sports. And, you know, life kind of gets in the way. And when I got out of college, I ended up taking the easy way out in terms of to make money. But at the same time, I was helping out the family, and, you know, things were a little bit crossed up at the time, and I had a job in sales that I was pretty successful with, and I had stuck with it, and I wasn't sure whether or not I was going to ever get back in this business, because when you make money and you're successful, and, you know, I was working down in the stock market area downtown in New York and wearing a suit every day, and all of that just seemed like that was going to be my life, and I realized I wasn't happy. I moved out to Los Angeles for a couple of years. That didn't do anything for me, and you know, I realized what was missing was doing this. And, ironically, at the time when Dream Job started, I was paying radio stations for airtime just to be able to, you know, get a studio and to make tapes and send them out to people. And I had sent them to agents who, you know, some didn't respond. I had one agent tell me I was never going to have a future in this business. There was all sorts of stuff going on. And I just was kind of plugging away. And then, what do you know, I think it was in March, my best friend, mother called me. I thought something was wrong with him. I answered the phone, and she said, hey, you know, sorry, don't want to, you know, disturb you. I don't know what you're up to, but I have to let you know that I heard this commercial on the radio yesterday. He's doing this audition for this reality show, and it's in New York, and it sounded totally what you're about, and it's been your dream, and I thought you should know, and it's tomorrow, and I know it's late timing. This must have been on WFAN or somewhere in New York. They were playing the station.
Yeah.
And I had actually, this was like an hour before I was leaving for the Giants-Cowboys game on Monday Night Football. And I was in my Dave Meggett jersey. And I went to the game, and I told my buddies that I was with about the game and about this. And you know, I wasn't going to do it. And I wasn't sure I was going to do it. And on the way back, I noticed they weren't driving me home. Apparently, when I was in the bathroom at the stadium, they had determined they were going to drop me off at ESPN Zone in the street at like 3 in the morning, and they did. And I was the sixth person ever online. They didn't start the auditions until like 8. I remember having to ask them to hold my spot so I could walk like 8 blocks to go pee. But in my Dave Meggett jersey, that's where it started. 5 hours later, I auditioned, and the rest was history.
How long had you been thinking of fully leaving what you were doing to do this?
I've always been impulsive. I mean, I'm the guy who, geez, I was in a relationship and she cheated on me. We broke up and I got rid of my car. So I've always been, I just didn't want to be in the car anymore. Before I moved out, and that's when I went out to LA, I was like, I dropped my job and just left. So I've always been that way. You know, I had thought about it for a while. I wanted to get into this industry, but it's hard. I mean, it really is difficult. It's difficult out of college. It's difficult no matter who you are. It's more about who you know. And it's, you know, I'm not an athlete, clearly. So it was something where I hadn't given up. But to be honest with you, I was, you know, if that door hadn't opened, and I'm always grateful for it, if that door hadn't opened, who knows what the heck would have happened. So, you know, it just was right place, right time. I was in the right mind frame. If that happened the year before, maybe I kind of blow right through it and blow it off. If my buddies don't kind of coerce me, you know, maybe it doesn't work out anyway. So, yeah, everything kind of happens for a reason. I believe that. I think the greatest word in the English language is opportunity. And I always tell this to people all the time is, you know, you never know when it's going to come, but you got to make sure when you get that opportunity and that door creaks open that you knock it down. And I've been trying to knock it down for the last 14 years ever since.
So here you are in the ESPN Zone in New York. It's 3 in the morning, you're in line for the audition, and obviously it goes well because you end up on the show. Talk me through that audition process, and did you have any idea of what to expect? Did you have any sort of training come back from your college days to prepare you for it, or did just sort of natural ability and talent kind of take over?
Yeah, you know, I don't know what the hell it honestly was going to be, and you get up there, and they had had like different groups, and from what I remember, they had like a debate section, like where you're debating with other people, which, as you know, and anyone who's ever listened to me, has definitely been an issue. So, you know, that part was easy. They had an interview process. They didn't really do anything. It wasn't like they were looking for people who were necessarily, at that time at least, in the audition process, skilled in doing a stand-up, reading a prompter, or any of that kind of stuff, doing highlights. So, you know, it was more just conversational and getting to know people. And it was like a six-hour day, and it was over, and I went home, and I went back to work. And I was an executive recruiter at the time. I was a headhunter. And I'm sitting there and calling VPs and, you know, taking them out of the jobs and putting other guys in jobs. And it's a thankless job doing that at times. And you know, that's what I went back to doing. And for 2 months at least, I never heard a word. So I thought I was done for it. I honestly, like, I don't want to say I gave up. I didn't give up on the industry, but I gave up on that. I was like, ah, geez, I must have not done it, or I must have done something wrong. And what do you know? I mean, my phone rang, and I don't remember necessarily, you know, what time of day it was, but I just remember sitting there and the person saying, you know, hi, my name is so-and-so, and I'm a casting director for Dream Job, and you've made it to the next round, and we're going to need you in the city. It was like 2 days later, and, you know, the only thing, they had cut it down, I think, from 10,000 at that point down to like 200 people.
Oh, wow.
And the only thing that they told me was you have a 2.5 minute, I can't remember the way they put it, like almost like a presentation that you have to do. The rest of it won't tell you, but you can prepare. Now, it can be, they said it can be, you know, it could be a fake broadcast. It could be, you know, something about your life. It could be anything you want. Like, they left it wide open, just 2.5 minutes to kind of have the floor. And I just remember, like, hanging up the phone and being like, what the hell am I supposed to do? Like, I called my mother. Like, I didn't know what. Like, I'm just, like, running it by everybody. So, long story short, and it probably helped me, but what idiot that I am, I'm like, yeah, well, you know what, I'm going to do to be different. So I came up with a 2.5 minute Dr. Seuss rhyme about my life. And the whole thing was, like, it was tongue-in-cheek, it was funny, but it was true. It was just basically about how everything from when I was 5 years old, about how I wanted to do this and how I'd gotten away from it and why. And I just remember the last two lines, just in case this is my only chance to enter, this is Casey Stern, and you're watching SportsCenter. And I just remember the people applauding, and the rest is history, man. We did stand-ups and sit-downs, and I interviewed Dontrell Willis. He was in there. We did some, like, mock interviews, and that's it, man. The next thing you know, I'm sitting there in a room, and they cut it down to 10 people, and Linda Cohn announced me, and I was on the show. So it was a crazy process. It was a dream opportunity for people who saw the show. They put me crying, calling my mother. I didn't know it was being filmed because to me it was validation. I always believed that I could do this, and I'd spent a large portion of my life in sports and out of sports with people not believing me, having low self-esteem, dealing with anxiety issues that I dealt with my whole life, and you know, it was really kind of a moment of validation that anything possible. And I've believed that ever since, and I've kind of preached that to anybody I know or have ever met ever since.
We're talking to Casey Stern. He is the host of TBS's pre- and post-game coverage of the NLCS. He's with Gary Sheffield, Pedro Martinez, and Jimmy Rollins. He's also a feature host on Turner Sports. You can catch him on Inside the NBA on NBA TV. He's also the host over at MLB Network Radio and Sirius XM of Inside Pitch, their afternoon drive show. I could talk about this with you for hours, but when you're there, when you're inside ESPN, and I want to ask you about Stuart Scott a little bit, because I've heard this is somebody that had such a presence, and he was super kind and very welcoming, but you also knew that when he walked into the room, that this was somebody that was just going to be able to command your attention. Was that being, I think you were, what, 25, 26 when you were in the process of this?
Yeah.
So you're standing in front of a guy that I'm sure you grew up watching just like I did, and what was that experience like to be able to see this guy, this iconic member of ESPN, and he's sort of going through this entire process with you?
Dude, at the time, I mean, honestly, I was like, you know, peeing my pants. I mean, he was very kind, but very, like, I don't want to say serious, but he understood the impact of what this was going to do. And look, you know, just to kind of take people inside and to understand, no, this is not a very well-received idea by a lot of people at ESPN that work there. This is not a well-received idea, which I learned more afterwards than at the time. This was not a very well-received idea by people in the media at all. Fans, yes, because it was the everyman's opportunity. For people in the business, and I get that knowing people now, it was somebody skipping a lot of steps. You know, they were in Duluth or somewhere in the middle of Nebraska or who knows where, trying to, you know, one-man bandit and, like, videotape themselves and then send it in and try and get a report in and to sell a story. You know, here was somebody who's going to kind of skip a lot of steps. So there was an aura to that from him in terms of the fact that he wanted everybody to know how valuable of an opportunity this was and how grateful we should be. But he's very kind, definitely a presence. And honestly, like, everything about that whole experience was, you know, I'll never forget, I remember the first episode. Most of it was live. Some of it's live to tape. But I remember we did live to tape, I think, the first segment of the first episode, and we're all standing in, like, a semicircle. And, you know, they're going, like, camera guy, like, right up in your face. And, look, I had no experience doing that. I'm on TV, and they're staring at you, and your Stuart Smith is, like, reading, like, your resume, which at the time was, like, I'm a 25-year-old executive recruiter for Delmore who likes long walks on the beach, whatever the hell he said. And I just remember, honestly, the only other time in my life I've had that feeling is when I bounced the ball to the plate at Kauffman Stadium throwing a ball in the Futures game for the first pitch. Because I looked up at the big screen, I saw myself in, like, 100-million-foot screen, and I nearly pooped my pants. So I just remember the nerves. I was in awe. I mean, I was absolutely in awe of just the opportunity to even be in that arena, for sure.
You mentioned the idea of when you were growing up and wanting to do this, but also dealing with sort of the anxiety of it and dealing with sort of your own fears and overcoming a lot of those elements as well. Does that surprise people when they talk to you or people meet you and they hear that this is something that you went through early on in your life? I feel like, especially in our industry, people just assume that, oh, we talk for a living. We were, like, the most confident people coming out, that nothing could deter us. We were always winning debates. We always felt great about ourselves. But in reality, no, we're just like everybody else. It's just when the red light comes on, there is an innate ability to feel at home and comfortable in what we're doing and what we're saying.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, I don't know if this is news to, like, more people who would care, but this is, I've never really talked about it, honestly, because I never wanted to be the guy who was trying to promote something he's gone through so that, you know, look, you always want other people to kind of learn from your experiences, but I'm person to person that way. I didn't want it to look like I was trying to say, hey, look at me and what I've accomplished. But yeah, I've dealt with anxiety for many, many, many years, clinically. And, you know, I've always had a hard time with it, from socially to, yeah, just to everything. I remember at times many years ago before I really sought out help for it, where I would be driving and be late for something for literally like 4 or 5 minutes, and you would have thought the world was ending, just beads of sweat down my face and all that stuff. So I've dealt with a lot of that, and I think, you know, for me it leads to, for a lot of people go through it, a lot of low self-esteem and a lot of concern and a lot of, you know, a feeling of kind of inadequacy. And you know, the interesting thing for me, Ben, is that, which I think, you know, athletes talk about this in their own, you know, kind of arena, but, you know, the safest place for me has always been doing what I love, and that's talking about sports. And that's been, whether it's, you know, with people socially, it's the easiest icebreaker for me. It's been, whether it's, you know, sitting there, you know, at home growing up as a kid, it's what I always wanted to do. It made me feel comfortable. It's always been the place where I can escape when things are bad, you know, off the field, quote unquote, if you will, in your personal life. So, you know, carrying that to the set, you know, is something that kind of became easy for me as I did it. But yeah, it was hard at the beginning. I mean, it was really, really hard because, you know, to me, stage fright is something that's a serious thing. And I think, you know, the one thing I always try and explain to people, and I used to say this when I was sitting there in high school and I would get up and do a book report and get really excited and you know, have fun with it. As long as you know what your topic is, you know, imagine if you're going up in front of a room or in front of a million people and they asked you to talk about your brother or your sister. Really easy. So as long as you prepare, it takes down that anxiety. And for me, I've gotten through that, to be honest with you, more than anything else with preparation. And I prepare, I would like to say, as hard as anybody, And that, to me, has been the best way to kind of cut down that demon, if you will, at least when I'm on stage. But that's my safe zone, man. I said it on here the other day, actually. You know, for me, that's the sorry board game where you get in that safe zone and nobody can touch you and you can't knock your pieces off the board. That's how I feel once I get mic'd up or put a headset on.
Well, I can certainly attest to your preparation. I remember putting together some of those rundowns with you, especially for when you were at MLB Network Radio and you had the on-site shows, because there's so many moving parts and there's so many different components to that show. And you could be going right from one interview right to the other, and we had to be prepared back in the studio for anything that would come our way. And I remember just knowing that type of preparation that you had to make sure not only that you were ready, but I think having a sense of making sure that we were ready, I think certainly probably helped all of us out. But I want to finish this up, because the show happens and you do well, and then what? What happens from that point forward where it's a success? You didn't end up finishing at the top, but it still translates into the next direction for your career. What happens after that?
Yeah, well, after that, which is crazy. So I get kicked off, and, you know, honestly, learning experience, but I have no problem sharing this, but, you know, I came in fourth or fifth on the show. I think it was fourth. But I got kicked off in part because I just completely blew it on trivia. And, you know, it's interesting because I would say know as much about that stuff as anybody. And I would say, with no disrespect to any of them, maybe more than anybody who was on that show. But I failed because the night before I was too concerned about, you know, enjoying the lifestyle of, you know, being filmed, and, you know, we were out and having a good time and didn't get enough sleep and wasn't enough prepared. And I learned a lesson. I think it's part of the reason I ended up going home. But literally 2 days later, my phone rang. Tony Kornheiser had tracked down my phone number and called me, spent an hour on the phone with me, telling me just advice, and, you know, that he thought I had a bright future and he really thinks that I can make it, and, you know, giving me some contacts. And, you know, he ends up bringing up the name of now my current agent, who also, Seth Davis at the time, through a family friend, had done the same thing, who was his agent. So we connected, and after that, man, the rest is history. The first thing I ever did was I did voiceovers for through MLB.com Advanced Media. This is how long ago it was, for America Online highlights. I remember that was the first gig I ever had, and I remember I was sitting there through, like, I don't remember dial up at the time, but I watched those highlights. I was like, I couldn't believe I was doing an AOL highlight, let alone, I mean, I never would have thought I'd get to this point. So I was just, you know, grateful to even have that. But yeah, then I ended up at .com. I was there 6 years. I did pre and post for the Mets and the Knicks for MSG. I did all sorts of different things. And you know, then in 2008, December of 2008, when the network came into play, I was one of the last cuts. I did the audition there. I didn't get the job. You know, and I think, you know, the biggest advice I can give to people is, you know, setbacks only make you stronger. I've been told no a billion times in my life. In this career, there are people who are on shows that have gotten jobs that I went for and didn't get, and I'm sure the same thing happens for actors and entertainers and anywhere else, but it's always just kind of pushed me forward. So when I lost the gig at MLB.com, because they kind of closed pretty much our entire department at the time when the network came in, and I didn't get that job. About 2 days later, MSG canceled their programming that I was doing over there. Jonathan Coachman left, who I was working with. He ended up going to ESPN. Peter Savrasi went to the Knicks. That place, everybody had to kind of disperse to go different places, and I didn't have a job. And I literally had no employment. And this is, you know, a lesson I'll share, because I think this is important for young people who listen. MLB.com, who had already fired me or let me go, had given me an opportunity, because we were set to do winter meetings in Vegas, that they were going to allow me to go on the trip anyway so that I can network, which was nice of them.
Sure.
I turned it down and told them I was going to go, but I was going to work. That I was going to go, and I would, even though I knew that it was the end, I was going to go and do my job. It was the job that I was required to do. It was what I had promised to do, and I wanted to be there to work. So I went to Vegas, and I worked every single minute that I would have worked at Winter Meetings if I didn't know that my job was literally going to end the second I came off of air. And during that time period, and I believe in karma, and I honestly believe part of the reason this happened is because I did something most people probably wouldn't have done, which people would have said, you know, screw you, and just left. I ended up sitting there in a hallway having a conversation with somebody from Sirius XM, and it turned into what's now been 10 years of radio.
That's remarkable. It's so easy when you know that you've busted your balls and you've done everything for a company for as long as you have. When they tell you that they're letting you go, it's very easy to tell them to go screw off and to go kick rocks and do everything in your power to go immediately find another job. So I love hearing that type of story, that if you just keep pushing on, and it's not an easy thing for a lot of people to do, because a lot of that too, cases is putting your ego aside and saying, all right, this is another opportunity for me. And by not burning that bridge, that at least gives them a possible reference to come back and help me, even if it's not coming back with them.
No, and that's honestly been, it is so true. And it's always been that way, which is why I don't burn bridges. And I could sit here and tell you, and anybody can, this business, it's not a what was me thing. The horror stories of near misses, or I one job I was told I had that was taken away. I mean, everybody's been through all those sorts of stuff. And, you know, you have to realize that it's about when you look in the mirror, you know, the dignity you carry with yourself. It's not about how others see you. And I think, you know, that's what's been one of the biggest things that's gotten me to kind of where I am today, is that I'm always thinking every day about how I can be better, because I want to be better, not because others want me to be better or different or, you know, however. So, you know, I think, karma is a weird thing. I truly do believe that if I would have done what 95% of the people would have done and not gone on that trip to work because, you know, screw you, you guys are letting me go anyway, and I was still going to, you know, get, you know, an opportunity to, you know, network on my own, I didn't have to go work. If I didn't do that, I don't think I would be where I am. So, you know, I'm a believer in just, you know, make sure whatever you're doing at any point in your career, it doesn't have to be this one, that you remember that, you know, every step you take leads to the next one. So, you know, don't ever sit there and stop no matter what happens.
And I would imagine, too, that in the moments between being eliminated from Dream Job and trying to figure out what happened, and I'm sure the feeling of maybe it got away from you before having that conversation with Tony Kornheiser, like all of these feelings and all of these types of emotions and reactions come back to you later on. And that's like purely a lesson of understanding sort of where you were before and knowing that it's very difficult to let something like this slip away. And you had moments where it did. And now this is an opportunity for you to say, I'm not letting that happen again.
Yeah. You know, the other thing is, you know, once you get a taste that, you know, believing in yourself is the biggest thing. And I think once you get a taste of what it's like in that moment, you know, that was something I wasn't going to give up and I wasn't going to relinquish, and, you know, it wasn't going to stop me, because that was not, look, I go back to that time period in 08 and I was not in a good mental place. I mean, you know, from the anxiety standpoint, everything, you know, when anybody who's ever dealt with that, you know, or anything of that nature, you know, everything kind of, you know, rushes through you at any point where, you know, negativity kind of presents itself, and it was not an easy, I mean, look, even at the beginning, I remember sitting there, because I was doing, the first shift I did was Christmas Eve, I think, for Sirius XM. I did just a random shift on MLB Network Radio.
Yeah.
But that rest of that season, that's all I did. I did random shifts here and there. I remember a humbling moment for me was sitting there. I wasn't at the playoffs. I was, you know, wasn't at the All-Star game. I was throwing to the people who were doing those shows, and, you know, sitting there, you know, look, from where I was, and I understand, you know, now I think people get the difference between internet from, you know, where it was then, but at the time, people would look at MLB.com, okay, it's a website, but I'd done the Hall of Fame for 6 years, I was in the World Series clubhouses,
yeah.
I was there every day of the 04 run for the Red Sox. I mean, they had done a lot of really cool things, and then I was sitting there in a radio studio by myself, somebody, you know, not even on the other side of a glass, in another city in D.C., and I'm throwing out to all the people who are doing the jobs that I knew I should be doing. And all it did was drive me. But I never said no. I never didn't give 100%. I never had an attitude. And I think that all of that is what ended up leading me to at least get an opportunity to, you know, eventually get into that spot. But It was for that 6 months. Look, you're going to get humbled. You get humbled in baseball. Look at what Yasiel Puig is doing, and what has happened. And I tell people all the time, and I've had Dave Roberts on my show the last couple of years. Him getting sent down, I mean, I think changed his life. I mean, look, we all get humbled. I think that's where you learn your true character. And I think if I didn't go through that in those 4 months, 5 months in 2008, there's absolutely no way I would have been able to have the fortitude to get where I am now.
Yeah, I think a lot of people perceive it just to be something that happens with ballplayers. It can happen in any profession. Now, I'm in Kansas City. I've been here for the last 3.5 years. If Mike Moustakas doesn't get sent down in the midst of him hitting like about .174, I don't know if he comes back and ends up winning a World Series and now is on pace to get almost $90 to $100 million on the free agent market. It happens to everybody, purely not just on whether it's in a professional athlete career or anything. Something is going to humble you in life, and then ultimately it's about how you respond and how you move forward from it. So it's certainly very relatable in that sense, as we're talking to Casey Stern from Turner Sports here on the Awful Announcing Podcast. Kind enough to join us and give us his time here today. So let's continue on. You're at MLB Network Radio, and you're talking about the idea of wanting to be able to be in the clubhouses and to be able to be on site for all the different playoff coverage, and you want it to be sending it to you and not the other way around. So you finally get there. Is that feeling basically everything that you thought it would be and more, knowing that this is what you've been finally working for?
Yeah, you know, I think it was a couple of things. It was for a second, it's validation because you know that you could do it. Look, I always say this, and people, I think, feel bad sometimes about the idea of pride, because being prideful sometimes is turned into a negative nowadays because people are too prideful and it turns into ego or being arrogant. But I think when you're proud of yourself, that's honestly the greatest feeling in the world. And I think, you know, to me, that's what happened when I remember going back in 2009, the World Series with the Yankees and the Phillies. And it's funny how all this stuff happens. You know, I had told them for a long time that I knew I could do it. They knew the experience that I had, but, you know, it takes time. I mean, look, these are people who don't know me. It's like going to a new team, and they had never seen me in that element. And there actually was a technical issue when we were out at the stadium. I think we were at Yankee Stadium during the World Series. And, you know, I basically had to, you know, host the post-game show from there, even though I wasn't supposed to be doing that. And it kind of changed everything, and the rest is history. And, you know, for me, the other thing that it does is it pushes you, because, you know, I remember I am somebody who has, I don't listen to my everyday shows. I don't, outside of little segments, I've never really listened to from the day-to-day basis, but from the remote, I've listened to them all, because every single one, I'm sitting there taking notes on myself and saying, this is what I can do better. And, you know, never wait for other people to pinpoint, whether it's today's day and age Twitter or a boss or somebody else. Don't wait for somebody else to point at you and say, this is what you need to do better or do different. You're going to be able to question and challenge yourself. And for me, I do that against the people who I respect. I do it against, you know, what I believe I should be doing. And that was kind of the beginning of a whole new chapter of my life, where every single day I got on the radio, I wanted to be better at it tomorrow than I was yesterday.
Did you ever miss the connection as somebody growing up a diehard Mets fan and somebody that had an important and a special connection to New York? You grew up with WFAN. Did you miss the connection of terrestrial radio and terrestrial radio listeners having one team and in one city? Because as someone who went from MLB over to Kansas City, it's an entirely different experience to be able to have that connection and trust with an audience, because you have those similarities together. You have the same team, you have the same city, you have that same experience. Was that a little bit difficult for you in the 9 years that you've been there?
Yeah, it was a little bit difficult, and I'll be completely honest. As I started to have success with this show, and it, you know, became something that was, you know, recognized, you know, from a baseball standpoint universally, I always thought that phone would ring. It never did. You know, I always wondered during the first 3 years, and I wouldn't now because I got too many things going on anyway.
Right.
And I don't think I would ever go, I wouldn't say backwards from a job standpoint, but to me, I can't imagine dealing with the New York sports fan for 5 days, let alone for, you know, 5 years. There's no way I could do it. But at the time, I always wondered, like, if that phone rang, would I end up getting into that element? That's a Halloween thing in my house on your podcast that just went off. Sorry. So I always wondered whether or not that call would come, and it never did. And, you know, I never got to feel that. But to be honest with you, I think it ended up becoming a blessing. And the reason I'll tell you this is because I got to learn more about fans in other cities. And I got to learn more about what they go through. I got to kind of live through their experiences with them. So it wasn't just about understanding, you know, what Met fans and Yankee fans and Knicks fans and Giant fans had gone through. It was getting a chance to kind of open up a whole new world. Because even though I covered players, in living in New York, you know, I'm sitting there and really from a fan standpoint talking to New Yorkers, getting to open up over the last 9 years, I mean, I feel like I understand the plight of the Brewer fan as much as I would anybody else in New York. So it's been a benefit to me. I think it's an unbelievable platform because you get so many people that are involved. And I say this wholeheartedly, honestly, and you know me, I never mind being honest. I think the intelligence of the listener from a not a general, but I would say from a majority standpoint, the intelligence of the listeners we have because of the platform we're on is at a way higher level from a sports side than you're going to get if you're sitting there in the New York area on WFAM, because we're not getting the guy who wants to go ahead and trade for Mike Trout and he's willing to go and give up the backup catcher to do it. We don't get those kind of calls, thank God.
I always thought that was a benefit, even if, and it's not just on the baseball channel. It's on the fantasy channel. It's on the football channel as well, because you're getting perspective from everywhere. I kind of compare that to different news outlets as well. You know, if you're only sitting in your own city, yeah, you're going to have a little bit more inherent trust with the people that you're talking to from a national level. But at the same time, you don't allow yourself to open your mind to see, well, what else is happening in the country? What else is happening in the world? If you incorporate both into your life, then you at least are allowing yourself to have different perspectives.
Yeah, look, I agree with that, and I think, you know, the other thing is that you lose the fandom. It's so interesting because something that I hear often, and Twitter to me, which is overall a cesspool of negativity, it is something that I have because you have to have it. I enjoy, in terms of, in some senses, talking to some of the fans and the listeners, and I enjoy it because I get information. It is a great example of kind of, you know, what you don't want to know about the world. I think when you sit there and you broaden yourself out and you kind of learn about people, not everything's going to be good, but one thing I hear about all the time is, oh, well, you know, he's just a Mets fan, or, you know, he's, you know, I'm sitting there yesterday and, you know, oh, he's, I had, in the same minute, I hate the Cubs, and then I had another guy say I hate the Dodgers. So, you know, of course, I hate
every
team.
Tough to do when you hate both teams,
guys. You know how those things go. We're all biased. We all hate every team. So not everything you learn about people doing this job is positive, unfortunately. But the one notion that I can kind of just sit there and just crush for anybody who actually thinks it's an issue is when you do this, as long as I've done this now in this sport, there's no more fan coming on the air. Like, there's no, you know, I'm a fan of the sport, I'm a fan of players, but I'm more a fan of players than any that I know, that I like personally, than I am that I enjoy the way they play the game.
Yeah, and that's part of the process, too, is that when you start to build a lot of these relationships with guys, I remember, I think Todd Frazier was a weekly guest of yours for a long time, and I love that guy, purely based on the conversations and the interviews that he did with you guys, and even some of the managers, the weekly manager appearances that you had. That was the first time I really got to learn about Joe Maddon, and obviously being a Cub fan here, knowing that this was the type of guy that was going to be so loose and different and out of the ordinary, you get that type of perspective, and then it becomes a lot easier to root for. Hell, Casey, growing up a Cub fan, I became a Pirates fan in the process of working for MLB Network Radio because Jimmy T, their director of media relations, would get you anybody on at any time. Oh, you want Andrew McCutchen today? Done. And so that changes your perspective on all of this, too.
Yeah, and people understand, like, the relationships, and that's what's important. I have an easy job because the people who break news have it way harder than I do. My job is to basically give my opinion, sit there every day and to have a conversational relationship with the listener. And it makes it easier for me to build rapport with players in some senses because they know whatever they tell me I'm not going to say because I'm not trying to break news anyway.
Right.
So, you know, pretty much 95% of the conversations I have with players are off the record.
And then, you know, the other side of it is not as easy because they listen. You know, players do listen. I have had, I won't name names, I have had a couple of players come up to me at times. And look, the way I always put it is, you know, this is a thankless job sometimes because you have to be the guy who has to say, you know, hey, look, the manager didn't do a good job and here's why, or the player should be benched and here's why. But you got to take personal out. And one of the things I absolutely cannot stand about a lot of the media that we have today is people who take it personally. I saw something about Terry Collins from somebody who's got a check mark next to their name with the word loser. You hear people, you know, talking. I remember he looked about by you, Ned, over the years.
Yeah.
I can name the names of prominent writers who made fun of him mercilessly that I then sat in the dugout and they smiled with their faces hurting, ear-to-ear smiles, asking him questions. I know that there are several people that I know personally who have blasted Mike Piazza day after day for every pockmark and acne and everything else. And I covered the Mets, and I remember watching them every day glean and smile ear to ear while they asked them questions. I just don't ever want to be that way. So one thing about me is not every player is going to love me. I do have certain relationships, but I have had people come up to me and say, hey, why the hell would you do this, or what the heck are you talking about, or what do you know? And I stand there and I tell them the truth about what I think, and you know, you try and be respectful, but at the same time, at least be able to show your face and stand up for what you're talking about. And that's one thing I love about radio. Everything's recorded. So anything I say, anything I put out there now to you, I know can be listened to. And I'm willing to take that, but at least can we have the media, please, from a whole, at least be more of a stand-up environment than it is, because it's really disappointing in an environment that I always dreamed of being in, what it's become. And I don't think from a whole, I don't think it's where it needs to be.
I'm with you as far as transparency and honesty goes. And as far as as long as you're going to say what you're going to say, if you can go and have that same conversation with the players, and it's something that I talk to my hosts about on a daily basis as well here in Kansas City, you have to know that what you're saying has consequences, and what the consequences have to be is you have to be liable for it, and you have to be transparent with what you say. So I think that's a good lesson for everybody, and know that if you just delete a tweet that you sent out because you said it in the moment, at some point someone's going to screenshot and it's going to hang around with you for a while. So you know that it's going to be out there. I want to get to your time working with Turner. We had a conversation at the beginning of the show about being prepared and knowing exactly what's coming ahead and having the right notes and the right situations and being prepared for whatever situation unfolds. You go to Turner, and with their type of pregame and postgame coverage, and this is what I've enjoyed about it the most, it's about as free-flowing as it possibly gets. Certainly on the NBA side, I think it's a little bit more structured on the baseball side. But that's a difficult thing, because in working with you from before, I remember this is what was happening in this segment, and this is where we're going to go from there, and this was happening next. When things are as free-flowing as they are, and Pedro could take something in an entirely different direction, he's that good and he can do it, is that something that's been difficult for you to get back on track on, or because you've sort of built this up over time, it's now a lot easier for you?
No, yeah, honestly, not really, only because, you know, to me, I understand what my role is there. My role is different when I'm on radio than it is when I'm here. But, you know, one of the things that's great about this group, and this is the most important thing. Look, I am a huge believer in chemistry in baseball. I think it's why, and I'm not saying this just because you're in Kansas City. I've said this many times before. In my 14 years, it is not even close. The best, most tight-knit group that I covered was the group out by you the last number of years, and that is the biggest reason they won. Bigger than their bullpen, bigger than any on-base percentages or statistics or sabermetrics, that group absolutely would have gone bell-to-bell for each other at the blink of an eye. And I think, and I mean this sincerely, like, I've never seen a group like what this group has been. And it was like that when we added Dusty, and it's been like that when we added Jimmy. We laugh for hours. All we do is spend the entire night laughing. Our meetings are supposed to be 15 minutes. They're 45 minutes because we're just making people laugh by, you know, ripping each other. Now, I was enjoying the fact that, you know, we got into Jimmy Rollins and I got into a conversation last night when we were arguing with each other. And he and I, I hate to say this, but this is good. I hope people listen to this on Twitter. We were actually making fun of the people on Twitter and reading them out loud down the line to the in the control room, who are tweeting us about how we hate each other and it's a Mets Phillies thing or though that ass has always hated the Phillies or all this other stuff. We literally could not get along tighter. We're together all the time off set, on off days. And I think because of all of that, nothing can be hard. I mean, we're playing each other, you know, and doing some crazy things that make no sense and having fun with it. And I think, you know, that to me is what I love about Turner, Ben, is that, you know, this is the place that fits me. I believe we're too Dateline NBC. I don't like hosts that sit there and, you know, tee up and feel like they don't deserve to have a voice. Why the hell not? I mean, I just don't understand that. I don't like when, you know, we're dealing watching shows with total running times of, you know, a guy turns towards the camera like Beverly Hills 90210 at the beginning of the show in some awkward, you know, camera shot and talks for 17 seconds while he stares at you. Nobody stares at a camera and talks. You talk to somebody that you're next to. That's why you never see us sitting and staring into cameras. And I cannot say it enough. They will have to drag me lifeless out of this place to not work here again, because this is exactly to me what sports is supposed to be. It's supposed to be entertaining. It's not supposed to be serious. And I honestly, with no respect to anybody else anywhere out there, I feel luckier than a pig you know where that I got in this place, because this is absolutely the place that is the best suited for the way I like to work.
I would imagine, too, in DVR culture and skipping through and everything is on demand, that the pre- and post-game shows, a lot of the times people are just, all right, I just got to focus on the game. I'm just going to come home. I'll watch it. I'll catch up to it later. But I think in order for that type of format to be successful, it has to provide something different. You wouldn't be able to get in any other type of situation, other type of format. So was that part of the conversation as well, knowing like, hey, we have to be different and we have to be unique enough to make sure that people are still paying attention to not just the game, but also to us?
Honestly, the biggest thing when I got in and it was weird because I did not think that this was going to be a possibility for me. And I don't necessarily know if they thought it was going to be a possibility for me either. I'm pretty sure positive, and there were a number of people that auditioned for this spot. I was the only guy with a radio background that did it. Everybody else were TV folks that were known. And, you know, Olbermann had been there before, and you know, hi, Joey, how am I going to kind of relate to that? And I'm a different person and all that stuff. I threw all of that out the bell. I told them from day one, and they told me from day one, and we told each other on the set from day one, we're just going to be us. And that's, now we'll hone us, and we'll try and get things better. And I feel like we're in a better group now than we've ever been. We're just get to know each other better. We're, you know, we're figuring out new ways. We did a demo yesterday, which I think is the best. The best pitch recognition demo I have seen in the history of my lifetime. That Shep and Jimmy did, taking live BP against Pedro in our studio yesterday. We're finding nuances and different ways, but we're just ourselves, man. I mean, honestly, there's not, like, I've been in other production meetings. There are people who might be even listening now who have been in other meetings. I know how they are. God, they're boring. Like, I know what they're like at other places. I've been there. And this is totally different. This is entirely, we don't rehearse. We're not going out there and going through, don't rehearse anything. We are out there just being ourselves, having a conversation. And that, to me, is what has made this thing so special, is they're not asking us to do or be anything that we're not. You know, when I went out last night and I got all over Joe about Wade Davis and got involved in a conversation, because I've been covering this game 14 years, nobody yelled at me and told me to shut up because I'm not a player. You know, nobody sits there when Pedro, you know, goes off and just starts talking Spanish and says, hey, no one wants to hear that. Nobody sits there when, you know, Jimmy starts showing off his bling and pointing at the screen and having a good time and says, well, we can't waste time doing that. This is a different arena. And that's why every tweet any of you people send that tells us that you think I'm biased or you think that we're having too much fun or what, I can't believe it's gone off the rails with all this crazy stuff that's gone on.
Who cares? You guys are having fun. It's relatable.
Go to the golf channel. Go play golf. Go play shuffleboard. Go sit there and you know, go and you know, do the crossword puzzles in the New York Times because I'm doing sports.
I appreciate your time, Case. It's been a lot of fun catching up and going through all of this with you. With the state of baseball right now, do you worry at all about baseball's, I don't want to say inability to connect with the younger audience, but the reality is that the target audience right now of baseball are are men in their 40s and their 50s, and they're, I know that Rob Manfred is understanding that there needs to be a way to further connect with younger generations and a younger audience, but is there ways in which you've thought about this, because you've been doing these shows for a long time, in which baseball could really start to get back on track and get themselves more connected to a younger audience to build up sort of that same type of love for baseball that you and I have?
Look, I feel very strongly about this. I've talked to Rob Manfred and Tony Clark and anybody who ever listened on my show a million times on the radio about this. Yes, yes, and yes. And it is with the opportunity to show personality, the opportunity to get our players to become more known commodities. It is a disgrace that, and look, I know how these lists are crazy and these, you know, you get all kinds of stuff, but, you know, ESPN's list that was put up, which is an actual survey of people, the most, the 100 known athletes or something like that. And I think Derek Jeter was the only baseball player that was in there playing anymore. We have got to do a better job. How does no one know what Clayton Kershaw does off the field? How do we not know what Andrew McCutchen has done in Pittsburgh? How do we not know how much fun these players are? I think about Brandon Phillips. The guy should be on Dancing with, no offense to David Ross, but we need the current stars to be on Dancing with the Stars. We need to throw a current star, not A-Rod, on Shark Tank. We need to throw a current star on Ellen and have them playing a game with some pop star that's going to bring in a cross-reference where all of a sudden people who don't watch baseball will be like, well, that dude's funny. Oh, wait a minute, I know a Yankee fan. I got to tell him how much I love X guy. Why do you think Aaron Judge has become so big? Yeah, the home runs are big. It's his size. It's because he's different. It's because people notice something different about him. Altuve, his size, people notice something different about him. We're not allowing players to be personable. We have to go have a weekend in August where we set up, we've got to put nicknames on the back, which was fine, and I thought it was fun and all of that, but we've got to do that, and it's almost like people who don't treat their loved ones well and then only do so on, like, Valentine's Day, or don't respect, you know, what happened in the past to get us here, but only respect it on Jackie Robinson Day. Like, you can't be that way. We as a league and a sport have got to reach out to kids, not by saving 2 minutes and 45 seconds of airtime and shortening the game with pace the game, but by starting the game earlier, by making sure kids can be awake, by making sure kids know who their stars are, by getting baseball players out more in the community, because right now there is nobody playing stickball like I was as a kid when I wanted to go be Keith Hernandez or Dykstra or Darryl Strawberry with a piece of chalk making a strike zone. No one's doing that anymore because no one knows at all nearly enough about any of the players they love to want to be them. We need to get them off the field, out of their element, into pop culture, and into the minds of some of these kids so that when they grow up, they want to be like X guy, not going out and getting Kyrie Irving's sneaker.
He's Casey Stern. Great stuff. You watch him on TBS's pre- and post-game coverage of the NLCS currently going on with Pedro, Gary Sheffield, Jimmy Rollins. He's also going to be on NBA TV, TNT, and of course on MLB Network Radio on Sirius XM. Case, you're the best, man. I appreciate your time. This was a lot of fun, and have a great rest of your broadcast, man. We'll do this again soon.
Danny, you know what? I love you, and to all the people out there, appreciate it. Hey, look, love or hate him because many years ago, all that matters is you get a reaction. All I care about is that you love the game, because that's all we're trying to do is make sure that people love baseball. So appreciate either side you stand on.
My thanks to Casey Stern from Turner Sports and from MLB Network Radio for joining us today on installment 3 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. Thank you guys all for listening, for participating, and we look forward to coming back again soon in a few weeks. My name is Ben Heisler. Give the good people over at Awful Announcing a follow at Awful Announcing on Twitter. You can also follow me at Benny Heist. We will do this again soon. Thank you all for listening. Have a great rest of your day.